That's the great Stevie Wonder starting us off in the new year with Higher Ground. It's from his acclaimed 1973 album, Inner Visions. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and we do begin the new year with this particular broadcast. And we'll be taking a look at the hard choices we have to make in 2017. Even harder, I think, than the choices we had to make last year. But we have to deal with this straight on because it is here. The moment is here. The new year has begun the way 2016 ended, fraught with unsettling challenges. Typical year-to-year political carryover, you know, the kind we witnessed in the last 8 years. Well, that was year one, and then we moved to year two and year three. It was the carryover of the same administration. But even carryover under the Obama administration was scary enough. But 2017 is no typical year. It marks the beginning of a new era in U.S. politics. It is, in fact, a seismic shift not only in the meaning of politics and how politics gets done, but also how we, the people, deal with it. On January the 10th, when President Obama makes his farewell speech in his hometown of Chicago, he no doubt will recite, for the record, a litany of breakthroughs, progress, and accomplishments that the nation achieved and experienced under his 2 terms in office. Then, 10 days later, on January the 20th, President Trump takes his turn at the helm, and we can expect to hear from him a snapshot in his inaugural address of the sweeping changes his fear-inducing administration has sworn to make. The changes they have made or will make, notwithstanding, the question, as far as we are concerned, is what changes have we made? What changes will we make? it is, you know, we've been talking about this for some time, about changes. Changes are to be expected, but it's been a while since you can get the sense that the nation as a whole is apprehensive about these changes. But in a way, not really. When Barack Obama won, amid all the jubilation in one part of the country, there was great apprehension and even outright fear about what an administration headed by an African American creating history would do. What will it do with regard to the standing order, the standing political order, the way the country is run? He was feared coming in because, hey, you know, this guy is new. He had just done a brief stint in the U.S. Senate, but he kind of came out of nowhere. And next thing you know, we have to call him president. And that alone shocked people. It alone set people off. They had never thought in their wildest dreams that this would happen, that they would actually have to recognize, respect, and even call a black man president, Mr. President of the United States. This was just not in their cards. They'd never envisioned it. The same would have held true had Hillary Clinton won. There were quite a few people, millions of people, openly apprehensive and absolutely opposed to a Hillary Clinton presidency, even if it would have been history-making, and for good reason. There was also incredible support for her candidacy, also allegedly for good reason. You know, there was a moment there of history to be made, and many people thought that that was enough. That sufficed support for Hillary Clinton. But other people saw her administration, or if it were to have been an administration, as being a really bad blow to the country. So you will always get these two different and varying opinions on just about anything having to do with presidential politics. But that is expected. That is, quote, normal, unquote. And in many ways, it avoids the key question, because it's really not about the president, and it's not about presidential politics. It's really, for us, the question is about politics at home. What are our politics? And in what ways do we shape political outcomes in the United States? Given the choices we have now, given the situation we're in right now, in what ways can we say we have shaped both the outgoing presidency, the outgoing administration, and the incoming one? What was our relationship to the Obama administration and its relationship to us as a collective, if you will? What is to be the relationship between a Donald Trump administration and us as a collective? I've remarked several times that it is quite apparent, even going back to the Obama administration, since we're talking about these two most recent administrations, that as a significant part of the electorate, what would you say was that was the nature of that relationship. Did the Obama administration, did President Obama really deliver for us? Really, did he leave room for input from us? Or did he follow the standard operating procedure? It applies to both Democrats and Republicans. And that is, look, we need you up until the point of the vote. After that, you know, you could get lost and we'll see you in four years. Unfortunately, many sectors of the electorate obey that implicit command. We too take on the instructions, and sometimes we don't even have to be instructed. We know what we need to do. We need to step aside. Other people don't, but we have a sorry history of stepping aside once the elections are over, and we kind of go into hibernation for 4 years. And then we come out of hibernation when the next round of the presidential elections are to be held. In other words, in many cases, we are part of the problem in that we abrogate our responsibility to continue the fight. We just move out of the way, and we let administrations do whatever they want to do based on some ridiculous theory that we don't want to interfere. You know, like if you like Obama, you say, well, we don't want to interfere with the thing. You know, he'll make some mistakes, but we can survive them. We give him a pass. We give him a lot of leeway, even for some of the most outrageous things that his administration did. The neglect, the setting aside of high priority items in favor of those items that powerful organizations wanted him to pursue. And he did that. A good example would be the situation with Israel. There was a big hue and cry about the acquiescence of the Obama administration to the Netanyahu administration of Israel. And even in nominal ways, that the broad constituency that did oppose many of the things that the Obama administration did to acquiesce to Netanyahu's Zionist demands, we just weren't loud enough. We weren't in the fight. We didn't press the cause. We abrogated our responsibility to see to it that this is an issue that matters greatly to us, and we want to, in solidarity with people in Israel fighting against the Zionist regime. And there is a very brisk opposition to Netanyahu. It's not reported at all or much in the United States media. But there is a very, very active opposition to the Zionist regime. But we dropped the ball here. We dropped the ball. And we let it go through. And we did not take any sanctions against Obama here in the United States for openly just engaging with a Zionist government, despite the broad opposition here in the United States. And in that matter, the Obama administration absolutely carried out every single wish of AIPAC, the American Israel, they call it the public affairs. That's the name they give themselves, not lobbyists, but the Public Affairs Committee. And so, even to the extent that President Obama and congressional representatives tolerated, in fact, some were quite pleased with the idea that Netanyahu would come to the United States, insert himself. This is now, you're not hearing any discussion about electoral interference, but that's what he did. He came to Congress. He pretty much took it over, wagged a finger, an accusatory finger, a finger of blame at the president, openly told Congress what they needed to do, shamed the president, and got away with it, and got away with the money that he came here to get. Now, that was a very glaring example of the weakness, the political weakness, or the choice to be politically weak at a time when the opposition needed to be very strong. The irony was that there was incredible opposition to it in Israel by activists there. Here in the United States, the activist community was not particularly effective at registering its displeasure about that particular incident. We know already where Trump is going. We have seen from his lineup that he's proposed, he's still filling out his cabinet, but for the time being, we can get a sense of where he's going to be going. What is going to happen to these things called policies? What will be the policies that this administration is likely to pursue and likely to enact, strengthened by the fact that not only is there a Republican in the White House, but that Republicans control both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives. They also have captured the lion's share of governorships and state legislatures. So it's a clean sweep. We have a change of course, a dramatic change of course, occurring at all levels. And we have this ideological twist as well, accompanying it, predicated on it, as a matter of fact. In the scheme of things, really, this is not surprising. It is remarkable, just the same. It is a remarkable thing, but it's not surprising. Because we saw over several years the implosion of the Democratic Party becoming more and more irrelevant to the people's struggles, becoming more and more oppressive. So there was very little difference. It was almost cosmetic, really. Very little ideological difference between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. They invested a lot in the persuasive methods of getting people to believe that there was, in fact, and there still is, some major, major ideological difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. That's not the case. But a lot of money has gone into creating that impression so that people will toe the party line, because in the end, it was a contest but within the duopoly, the Republicans and the Democrats still dominated the political contest. They have to create the illusion that they're very different from each other. And so they did. In critical ways, they distinguished themselves from each other, again, to let people think that there is an extraordinary, a vast difference. It's no longer just a sliver of a difference. It is a huge chasm, and one is absolutely the better choice. The other should just be forgotten, thrown away. It's time for a new day. Here we can therefore accept throwing aside the historical model of here we have a president who is actually a businessman. And his cabinet reflects his business acumen and interest. So we have a true oligarchy. On the Democratic side, we just have a pitiful choice. We have one of the most incredibly compromised, and I'm being very kind, candidate here in Hillary Clinton. And the level of corruption and the level of even the party eating and devouring itself in order to keep one candidate standing, Hillary Clinton, it devoured the others. It threw the others to the sharks, which also happened to be themselves. So they ate their own, a very vicious campaign. And the vicious campaign wasn't necessarily just against Trump. The vicious campaign was against their own. They made sure that there was to be no other candidate for consideration, for serious consideration, but Hillary Clinton. In one way or the other, they destroyed the candidacies of all other potential and actual competitors. Really nasty stuff. But that, in the end, is how political parties historically behave. Their system, which is observed by both parties, is however you win, it's okay. And that produced Donald Trump, and it produced Hillary Clinton. Because the systems allow it. In fact, that's the way they operate. All things are within consideration. But I want to talk about our behavior. Because the system continues with tweaks here and tweaks there, and in some cases we will have dramatic changes, but we should expect that. That is not something that should take us by surprise. We must look, however, in this new year, at our own behavior, our own political behavior, and how we participated in creating havoc, in retarding progress and growth. We did not do well at all. And so the people, the masses of people, are once again at a point of having to create from scratch some system, some method of defense. And we have to be very, very honest about it. We were clear that the Republican Party was not a good choice. The Democratic Party was not a good choice. That's settled. But what did we do? And it's not just that we didn't do very much. It was also that we did not have in place anything really to help us do something different. There was no vehicle to accommodate a constituency or constituencies yearning to exercise their political will through something they considered useful, relevant, and likely to succeed. We did not have that happening in 2016. Now, some people would disagree with that, and I would be happy to engage in a discussion with that about that. But from what I saw of 2016, we did not have much of a punch. We did not have effective ways of combating the power structure. We did not have well-organized systems in our communities to be available to us to say, well, okay, we're growing significantly, we're striving. We're, as we used to say, we're on the move. We did not have enough of political choice, nor did we have parties that were well organized and able to accomplish a certain set of goals. We just did not have that. And that is what we need to organize. We need to examine and organize. Why was it that we, as a group, performed so abysmally? To go on in 2017, as usual, I warn you, is absolutely fatal. And we're close to that point. We're close to that point. Maybe I'm wrong, but that is what I saw for the entire year. As you know, I talked about it over and over again. We do not have effective means of opposition. And principally, it is because we are not organized at all. We're not organized. We talk about it. We represent that we are organized. We talk about how serious we are and how much we are opposed to the standing order. But there is little or no evidence that we have converted all these things that we're talking about to action and to organized action. The organized action that we have witnessed in 2016 has been sporadic and spontaneous and short-lived, as it has been for decades now. The system knows this. A lot of noise would be made based on issues and events that are touching people and resonating with people in a particular way that gets them riled up. But the system also knows it will pass. And if it doesn't pass fast enough, it owns the methods and the ways to contain whatever opposition emerges. We spent a lot of time in 2016 talking a lot of stuff, when in fact our job was to have paid attention to organizing. You could talk all you want. The system understands that it can fracture whatever it is you come up with. It controls you. But we are still in 2017 now, following the same outmoded and largely irrelevant tactics of the 1960s, thinking that somehow it will be effective in 2017. That tells you how distant we are from reality. We also have not held parties claiming to be progressive accountable. We have not held them accountable, and we have not outed them for the deliberate ignoring of what people are trying to communicate to them as where we need to go as a group. They appear to have had no interest in that. It seems as if they were running on their own isolated ideas of how you do politics in 2016 and 2017. They're not listening. They have become the enemy. They're practicing the same approaches, holding to the same tired ways of doing things that are guaranteed to create failure. They're not moving. They're not growing. They're not working at being relevant. We have to call that out. Because it is inevitable that if it keeps going this way, more and more people will be like me. And I don't say that in an egotistical way. They would be like me in the sense that they would turn off. They will see no distinguishing characteristics among any of the parties, because in effect, they are talking the same language. They're using the same approaches. And they are refusing to do the work. The work is organizing. I can't say that enough. The work is organizing. And if you want some more proof about how important organizing is, you look at the Green Party. When it first ran, it got 3% of the vote. And other people would say, well, that's nothing. To me, that was significant. Just the fact that 3% of the population, the voting population, could see merit in a vehicle that brings a whole bunch of people together and through their votes support it. That was a significant achievement. So you asked for help, you got it. I'm not concerned about it being only 3%. I'm saying that 3% was itself a victory. And that was more than a decade ago, or two decades ago. And therefore, we are correct to ask the question, how is it that we have not moved in this election cycle beyond 1%? You've actually lost ground. Somebody has to explain why that happened. It is now 2 months since the election. We have had no explanation at all for some of the most improbable actions taken by the party and how it chose to utilize the financial support that it got, why it chose to assist Hillary Clinton's attempted comeback when it should be organizing. Because the truth of it is that with all of the other parties out there that are similarly situated in terms of lack of a constituency, same thing because of not organizing, not being clear about your message, not being accessible. A lot of mistakes made. And it couldn't have been made at a worse time. This isn't the time to make these kinds of mistakes. We are supposed to have benefited from decades of instructions on what not to do and how you grow a movement, how you get rid of impediments to progress early in the game, how you strategize, how it is important to have well-practiced tacticians who are less interested in talking stuff and more interested in doing stuff. And I bring this now to you and me because this is now where we come in, and it is our job to compel them to do this. If they have to be, if it has reached a point where you have to be compelled, then we should be doing the compelling. The losses are not just about, you know, well, we gave it a try and it didn't work. The losses are the result of wrong-headed decisions and an absolute abrogation. I'm being hard now. An abrogation of what it is you're supposed to be doing. We need these parties. I have said so time and again. Despite the fact that it may sound like I hate these parties. No, I hate what they're doing because they're blowing it. And they are misusing our support. Their heads are someplace else. Ego tripping. And indulging in useless ideological or phony ideological discussion. This is a very straightforward, cut and dried thing that you got to do. You have to organize, period. And you have to be accountable as well to the people. This is not your own little personal agenda, your own personal project. You are presenting yourselves to people as a solid choice relative to our political, our collective political condition. This is not a joke. But if it is a joke, it comes right back to us again to indicate that we are not in the mood for jokes. If you're not ready to take on the responsibility of political leadership, then just don't. Don't enter the fray until you're ready and prepared. Don't run the game on people that you're in the fight. You're not in the fight. You're not even close to the battlefield. You're not in the fight. You're only deluding yourselves and other people that are well-meaning and want to support you. And that I object to. How do we know that you're serious? How can we tell that you are, in fact, deluding yourselves? Well, I spelled it out with respect to Bernie Sanders. How are you going to let somebody come in and you're going to adopt them as your leader? You require no credentials. You require no questions. You don't bring him before your committee. You don't bring him before the people, and they could ask questions and vet the man thoroughly. And you take a vote as to whether this person is someone we should support or not. And if it is agreed that he looks like a promising person to support, to come behind and do some groundwork to help him up the ladder against a Democrat, you have to discuss these things internally. Does that compromise the independence of your movement? Does it compromise even your so-called ideology? But if you're comfortable with him, where is the contract? Where is a negotiated term or terms under which you will form an alliance that would hold him to a certain kind of behavior, standard of behavior, what he can and cannot do with respect to your movement by not, tainting the integrity of your movement, which you're working like hell to build. He capitulates and betrays you, which I had warned. This is what's going to happen. I warned them. Well, they don't have to necessarily pay attention to me, but I'm saying that to indicate that if I could see it, how come you can't see it? And then he does exactly what he set out to do. He's going to get an entire battalion of people that he doesn't have to sweat and go and, you know, hit the pavements and court. It's free. And then when he does capitulate, you do nothing. You do absolutely nothing. You just kind of, well, you put your tail between your legs and you slink off into the somewhere, into the ether, which means that technically you no longer exist. You have lost your party because you're plain stupid. You refuse to understand how this game is played. And you refuse to protect the integrity of your movement. so that all those people outside of the core circle of decision makers, those 13,000 votes that he had, 13 million, sorry, votes that he had, Hillary Clinton gets free access to them, and she gets all, besides that, she gets an advocate. She gets an advocate using your hard-earned 13 million votes, which totally kills your movement. You're not going anywhere. So you've wasted time. You've wasted time, and you've blown the people's trust because you were not a responsible custodian of their votes. And that has to be said. And you're responsible. And you need to accept the blame for that. And it still isn't too late. You have to publicly admit what you did wrong. This is not supposed to be a secret. You have to have the maturity to come before the same people you too betrayed, because you have to understand that you did betray them by not publicly castigating the actions of Bernie Sanders and the Democratic Party. Because by then, the Democratic Party itself also sabotaged Sanders' own campaign. You didn't say anything about that. I mean, I don't understand what's going on in people's heads. And you know how I feel about the Green Party and its ridiculous actions, which were reckless and irresponsible, and betrayed the actual level of political understanding and skill that the Green Party actually has, which is not very high. If you could have somebody in your party running against the advice of your members of your steering committee and even her own running mate to do the bidding, you know, demand this recount, we know what it is. It's just craziness and utter stupidity to burden a fledgling party with the responsibility of carrying water for the likes of Hillary Clinton. You have to be dealt with publicly. You have to be called out. You have some explaining to do. Because in the end, you participated in denigrating the integrity of the votes and the confidence and the money given to you and to any other party that chose in the end to play ball with the Democrats. Again, it's 2 months. We haven't heard from the what's left of the movement, the Sanders movement. We haven't heard any explanations at all. And we certainly haven't heard any explanations from the Green Party. And those are just two examples, but they're the most significant examples because they presented themselves as viable alternatives. The assumption being that A, they were ready, B, they had the skills to understand this thing called politics, and C, they were dedicated to representing, genuinely representing, the interests of the people supporting them. They failed on all counts. And on top of that, they have decided to remain unaccountable. In other words, they're saying, well, it's none of your business. Why are you in this? You're not even a member of the party. Why are you in this? You have no right to criticize. And there's where it's different. I have the right to criticize. I have the right to criticize. Because I'm speaking for the people who should be criticizing and are not. And this is not a trivial matter. We need to understand this. This is not a trivial matter at all. It is about moving in a new way, a new path. This is the essence of new politics. Accountability. People understanding the terrain. People getting themselves ready for battle in a sensible way. They understand the tactics. They have the knowledge, the skills, the expertise. In other words, they have prepared themselves to do battle at a level that can produce change. But now it is up to us to decide whether they're ready or they're not. And we should not feel in any way obligated to continue a relationship with any organization, any party that is underperforming. We have to be ruthless. This was my phrase many years ago. Ruthless and obsessive about our interests. Why? Because it's going to be hell. We don't have any well-functioning organization, political organization, that can competently flex our political muscle. We don't have it. It is, anybody looking at the history of these parties, you'll see perpetual betrayals. Perpetual lack of preparation, horrible decisions, reckless decisions. And we are supposed to forgive these things, and I'm saying no. Again, I understand what it is to climb a mountain backwards with 6-inch heels. I get it. I get how difficult it is. But these things that I'm talking about are the result of recklessness and poor decision making and a dissonance within the parties themselves. They don't seem to understand that they are performing the job of the duopoly, of the big parties, and of the system by inculcating or further inculcating a feeling of hopelessness within people, that they will never get anywhere with struggle. They will never win, but they will be inclined just the same to throw their support and their money and their time and their belief even behind people who are acting as if they don't understand the responsibility they have with just that. So I begin this year asking that we do some sober thinking. sober thinking. And if after careful review, you see a consistency that is very troubling, then it is up to you to make a decision whether you continue or don't continue. I made a decision a long time ago. I'm not a part of any political party. I certainly am not going to be a Democrat. That's about 20 years ago. I also made the decision at the same time, I will not vote unless there's a compelling reason for me to vote. There hasn't been one in 20 years, so I haven't voted in 20 years. I so look forward to voting. I so look forward to being part of a party that is up to snuff. You may be small, but you are bad. You are serious about what you want to do. And you are demonstrating in so many ways that you are on the right course. You understand your mission and you're following your mission. You're protecting the integrity of your organization so as to protect the integrity of the investments people are going to be expected to make with you. I haven't found that. I cannot abide the idea of trying to help myself and others through a collective process that is being guided, if I could use that word, by people who are reckless or insufficiently prepared and think it's okay. Let's get some new standards here in the new year, and let's get to the bottom of it all, which is we are in charge. We do not have to put up with this. It becomes a form of abuse. We should demand a certain level of performance in these parties and movements that we're investing in. If they're not coming up to snuff, you know what you got to do. Thanks for joining me today. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Molotovs and Meditations, or Meditations and Molotovs, sorry, with Vincent Emanuele. Reach me at leadstories, leidstories@gmail.com. Thank you so much for joining me today.